versus Chandler. Mr. Haas.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Drew Haase on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Joe Freeman. We're here today on the denial of a 60B motion following the denial of Mr. Freeman's habeas petition. And the primary issue here in today's case is a procedural one. It's a question of did the district court err in finding that Mr. Freeman's 60B motion constituted a successive habeas petition, where Mr. Freeman had raised the argument in his initial petition, it had been responded to by the state, but it had not been addressed in the district court's decision denying his habeas petition. Now, because Mr. Freeman did raise his argument in his initial petition, but the district court failed to consider it, his 60B motion was a true 60B motion under Gonzalez, and the district court did have jurisdiction to consider it. Therefore, the district court abused its discretion in holding that it was a successive petition, and this court should reverse. Now,
you lose on the merits anyway, I think.
Well, Your Honor, we do believe that Mr. Freeman does have, first of all, that his case does raise substantial constitutional questions that should be considered by the district court in the first instance, but that there are constitutional problems with Mr. Freeman's representation, specifically the denial of conflict-free counsel at the district court, at the
trial court. There isn't any indication that this lawyer testifying had any effect on the jury, is there?
Well, first, Your Honor, it was a bench trial.
It was a bench trial.
Right.
I mean, you're going beyond that.
Yes.
I don't see how it could have any effect on the judge at a bench trial.
Well, Your Honor, there were a few different types of prejudice that accrued from the dual representation and testimony by Mr. Freeman's counsel. First of all, the grounds on which Mr. Freeman's counsel testified went to the heart of his defense. He not only testified as to this prior incident between Mr. Freeman and the victim in the case, but also testified as to Mr. Freeman's alibi in the case, and then conducted the direct examination of Mr. Freeman himself, which undoubtedly any time that a defendant is called is a critical part of the trial. Now,
the alibi you're talking about is the McDonald's receipt?
Yes, the alibi is the McDonald's receipt.
I couldn't gather him saying anything other than that. Somehow or other, somebody gave it to him or something. Right? What did he know about who got the receipt and all that sort of thing?
I believe the testimony at trial was that Mr. Freeman had gone to McDonald's at roughly the same time that the shooting occurred, that Mr. Freeman later gave that receipt to his brother, and that his brother gave the receipt to Mr. Nemzin, who was Mr. Freeman's counsel, and then Mr. Nemzin offered it at trial.
So all he said is he got the receipt. He doesn't have any idea who went to McDonald's or anything else.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. Nemzin didn't testify himself.
Anybody could have got that receipt.
Well, that's one way of looking at the evidence on the record. However, the trial judge specifically said that she found the McDonald's receipt to lack any merit at all, that alibi was totally baseless. And I think it's not possible to say that Nemzin's testimony didn't play a role in that, the fact that he both testified and served as counsel. Now, there were other improprieties that also arose from that testimony. During the cross-examination, the state had the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Freeman's counsel, Nemzin, at which point they made clear that he was being paid by Mr. Freeman and sought to impute Mr. Freeman's other attorney, Mr. Hickey, the fact that the two were law partners, that they were the only law partners working in that firm, and, you know, kind of the level to which Nemzin blended his testimony and his lawyering, I think, came to a head when Mr. Hickey was performing the direct examination of Mr. Nemzin and actually asked for a moment with counsel while Mr. Nemzin was on the witness stand. The inability to separate the two, his testimony and his role as lawyer, did prejudice Mr. Freeman, even though it was just a bench trial.
And all the discussion about choice of counsel, because that was obviously closely questioned by the judge. Went through, are you sure this is the guy? Yeah. Now he's saying, well, they didn't say something about a conflict, but it seems that that was certainly implied, if not, you know, the court didn't, I don't remember the transcript, but didn't actually say, well, look, you know, he's in the law firm, and therefore that normally is a big conflict or something. Instead, he said, are you sure this is the counsel you want? And he kept insisting, yes, it was.
The trial court asked a series of questions designed to elicit the voluntariness of continued representation, asking him like questions such as whether he had any complaints about his lawyer, whether he was 100% sure he didn't have any complaints about his lawyer. Now, the trial judge asked one question that touched even remotely on the issue of conflict-free counsel, and it was this question and answer. No complaints whatsoever about Mr. Nemzin being a witness and now acting as your attorney? No, Your Honor. Now, that limited question and answer doesn't rise to the level of informing Mr. Freeman of the circumstances and the nature of his right to conflict-free counsel, and therefore cannot constitute a knowing and intelligent waiver of that right. Mr. Freeman didn't have any legal background, believe at the time of trial he had received a GED. That question and answer just doesn't raise to the level necessary for Mr. Freeman to have knowingly and intelligently waived that right to conflict-free counsel. Mr. Freeman's argument with respect to conflict-free counsel was raised before the district court in its petition. The state has admitted that in this case, and the state spent over 11 pages of its answer before the district court responding to that argument. Now, the district court's failure to address it gave way to Mr. Freeman's pro se Rule 60B motion. Because that motion neither sought to add a new claim nor attack the merits of the district court's decision, that constituted a proper Rule 60B motion under Gonzales v. Crosby. As this court has recognized, 60B challenges that go to the procedure of the district court, for example, the timeliness of a habeas petition, when a petitioner raises a 60B regarding the timeliness of a habeas petition, that doesn't raise any concerns under Gonzales, and that remains a true 60B motion that the district court has jurisdiction to consider. The district court in this case did have jurisdiction to consider Mr. Freeman's Rule 60B motion, held that it didn't, that was an error of law and abuse of discretion, and so therefore this court should reverse and remand for a consideration of the merits of the Rule 60B motion. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Haas. Mr. Fisher?
Good morning, Your Honors. Counselor, may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Garson Fisher for the respondent. I'll pick up where we left off by addressing the nature of the Rule 60B motion, but I think it's important first
you, you
to...
You say two opposite things in your brief about that, so...
I don't believe, Your Honor, we...
Page 18, you say petitioner cannot use Rule 60B to assert a new claim. And then on 22, you say... Because the district court denied petitioner's claim that his constitution was violated, petitioner's Rule 60B motion, in effect, asked the court to reconsider that claim.
Your Honor, the 60B motion can be viewed in either of two boxes, and petitioner loses in either one. I think it's first important to look at what was raised and wasn't raised in the petition and what was addressed and wasn't addressed by the district court, because obviously that frames the analysis of whether the 60B is a successive collateral attack. Petitioner raised a conflict-free counsel claim, but only intermingled with or conflated with this idea of choice of counsel.
Intermingled, and the judge didn't notice it. So he files his Rule 60B and says, you know, maybe because of clumsy presentation, you overlooked my claim.
I disagree, Your Honor, that the judge didn't notice the intermingled claim. there's nothing else
well,
that the district court...
Well, if he did notice it, that makes it a stronger case for regarding this as a genuine Rule 60B.
I disagree, Your Honor, if I can elaborate.
No, that's not right. If the judge recognized this intermingling, then Freeman is saying, look, you saw my claim, but you didn't handle it correctly, so I want you to reconsider.
The Judge Kendall addressed on the merits the intermingled claim that was raised. There's no other explanation for what...
Well, the judge said it wasn't raised. Explicitly.
An analytically distinct standalone conflict-free counsel claim was not raised. But there's no other explanation for what the district court was doing in the waiver section.
We have to psychoanalyze the district judge.
No, Your Honor, we just have to look at
his word.
Fuss about an issue like this. I mean, forget about it.
I'm sorry, which issue, Your Honor?
This business of whether it's a real 60B or a false 60B.
Well, because
a lot of
2244.
Yeah,
bars
but look,
a defendant
it's in
from bringing
there. The claim is
petition.
In there. It's not well articulated. It's in there. Anyone who reads it sees he's concerned about conflict-free counsel.
And to the extent that...
If the judge doesn't notice it, then he's Rule 60B says, look, I raised this, albeit very clumsily, and I'd like you to reconsider it.
To the extent that it is raised... The district court dealt with it on the merits, and asking the court to reconsider an issue addressed on the merits is also a successive collateral attack over which the district court...
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Look, if it's a real 60B, you know, it's the Gonzalez versus Crosby. If it's a real 60B, you say, Judge, you ruled against me on this ground, and you're wrong, you overlooked this, or... You know, when you made a mistake, a factual mistake, what are all the grounds in Rule 60B?
And
you raise one of those grounds, you're fine.
But none of those grounds are present here. In the habeas context, in a habeas context where a court addresses the merits of the constitutional claim, asking the court to reconsider the merits of that claim has been held to be a successive claim.
But if you say for... One of the grounds of Rule 60B is mistake.
Yes, Your Honor.
Say to the judge, look, you overlooked this issue.
And
or you cited the wrong case or something like that. You're pointing out a mistake.
Right. And to the extent that that petitioner is arguing that the district court, mistakenly overlooked a claim he raised, it's wrong for either of two reasons. Either because if he's saying he mistakenly overlooked a standalone, analytically distinct right to conflict-free counsel claim, the petition, which was counseled, doesn't raise that kind of claim. And to the extent he's saying you mistakenly overlooked the conflict-free counsel claim I did raise, which is sort of intermingled with the right to counsel of choice, I didn't know about the repercussions of my counsel's conflict, so I couldn't knowingly choose my counsel of choice, so on, that claim, in its conflated nature, was addressed on the merits by the district court. So in either box, his 60B constitutes a successive petition. But as Your Honors pointed out, there's no merit to the claim in any event. So this court could deny habeas relief as an alternative to affirming the decision that the 60B was a successive petition. The Supreme Court's never extended the Kyler rule about actual conflicts beyond circumstances that aren't present here, where an attorney represents multiple defendants with conflicting defense theories. So petitioner has to establish prejudice under Strickland. But the state appellate court's holding the petitioner failed to do so was not an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent. Nemzin testified favorably on petitioner's behalf, and contrary to petitioner's assertion, the trial court, and this can be found on pages 50 and 51 of the separate appendix, of petitioner's separate appendix, the trial court found Nemzin's testimony plausible. It was the only part of the defense theory of the case that the trial court did find plausible. The The trial court said that it found the victim's testimony, Gregory, and the eyewitness testimony, Tyler, to be credible witnesses and didn't believe a word petitioner said, in the trial court's own words. But it did find Nenzen's testimony that Gregory had approached him and you know, possibly attempted to extort money in exchange for dropping the assault charges in the prior case, found that to be a plausible, that testimony to be plausible. What the trial court didn't buy for a second was that Gregory had attempted to do it again. If anything, the trial court thought maybe that provided a motive for the petitioner to have targeted Gregory in the subsequent shooting. So there's no evidence on the record. In fact, there's evidence on the record that Nemzin's credibility was found to be solid by the trial court. And in terms of Nemzin's role in the alibi, he introduced the receipt. It's almost a chain of custody type of thing. I received the receipt. Here it is. His testimony didn't go to how petitioner got his hands on the receipt, and that's the part of the story that the trial court found to be totally wanting. And furthermore, there was ample evidence against the petitioner. You have Gregory's eyewitness account, which was supported by Tyler's consistent testimony and identification of the petitioner as the shooter. There's physical evidence, such as the number of shell casings recovered at the scene, that corroborate these eyewitness accounts. And when you compare the limited role that Nemzin played in the in-court trial representation, the nature of his testimony and the ample evidence against petitioner, there's no way that the state court's holding that petitioner failed to establish the prejudice prong of Strickland can be said to be objectively unreasonable. Additionally, petitioner knowingly and intelligently waived his right to conflict-free counsel. As petitioner acknowledges, the court asked directly, specifically, you have no problem with, you know, your counsel conducting direct examination of you having just played this role as a witness. I'm not sure what further the court needed or could have asked in terms of repercussions of that role, because as we've just discussed, there really weren't any negative repercussions to petitioner of counsel's dual roles in this particular case. So given the fact that you know, because of Musladeen and so on, Wright v. Van Patten, the petitioner can't attempt to apply an actual conflict theory here, and also can't establish that that the state court's holding on prejudice under a Strickland theory was objectively unreasonable, he's not entitled to habeas relief, and this court should deny habeas relief if it gets to the merits of the claim. But the court doesn't need to consider the merits of petitioner's claim.
What did the district judge say in his denial of Rule 60B that Freeman seeks to assert a claim of error relating to safety, but does not assert that his new claim is based on either a new rule of law or new substantive facts?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you point me to the specific reference?
In this is A1.
Oh, in the...
This as a... Isn't he saying he's turning down the Rule 60B as a...
I think that the district court's denial of the Rule 60B makes most sense if the motion is viewed in the first of those two boxes I referenced earlier. In other words, that the Rule 60B is asking the court to consider an analytically distinct, standalone, conflict-free counsel claim that's something different than the conflated, intermingled claim that was raised in the petition and considered there. The court's analysis in the waiver section, the court's footnote, the court's decision denying the motion all makes sense in that.
So much simpler for the judge just to deny the Rule 60B motion and say, no, there's nothing new here. My decision was correct. Instead of generating a procedural issue to split hairs over.
I don't believe the district court was attempting to generate a procedural issue. I think it was addressing the jurisdictional question, which is really what the successive habeas petition is about before it addressed any other issue. It doesn't have jurisdiction to address the Rule 60B if it constitutes a successive petition. My time is up, Your Honor, so unless you have any further questions, we ask that you affirm. Thank you.
So, Mr. Haas, do you have any time left? 1 minute?
Yes, Your Honor. Judge Posner, you pointed out correctly that the district court in its Rule 60B denial specifically said that it was finding this to be a new claim that it hadn't found raised before. Now, with respect to the boxes that the state attempts to put the claims in, either Mr. Freeman raised a claim with respect to denial of conflict-free counsel or he didn't. The state's admitted that he did, and the district court did not consider that argument. Therefore, this is a proper Rule 60B motion. Now, with respect to the merits, this court need not consider the merits in itself. Mr. Freeman raises a substantial constitutional claim. It was not considered by the district court. Therefore, this court should remand that claim to the district court to allow that court to determine the claim in the first instance, and therefore this court, if it considers the claim again, can do so with the benefit of the district court's prior analysis of Mr. Freeman's conflict-free counsel claim. So therefore, we would ask that this court reverse the district court's denial of the 60B motion and remand with instructions to consider the merits of Mr. Freeman's Rule 60B motion.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Haas. And you were requested to represent this.